Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As a quick reminder to those that are joining us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, you can find the chat room. If you want to, you roll in there with the usual suspects. We'll all be up there during the course of the show. If there is a question or an observation that you have in the course of the show, or if there's a question you would like for us to direct to our guest that you don't think that we're going to cover, that's a great place to put it in there, because we're more than happy to steal people who have better ideas than we do. And if you're new to Midrats and you're looking over the archive and see some shows that are always that are also interesting to you, or if you have to leave halfway through the show and you want to see what you missed, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio. Now, let's hop right in on the show. Some of the things that we want to talk about today is the new defense budget's out. We have the new QDR out. There's been a lot of discussions of that. More and more focus during the year, especially with President Karzai's statements that, you know, we don't need Americans here. We're going to be looking at how we're going to effectively withdraw our maneuver forces, or maybe even go towards the zero option in Afghanistan. And there has been a rising interest and desire for people to look at the Indo-Pac pivot, or to look at Africa and what we can do there. But as we're going to kick off the show there and what we've seen recently around the Black Sea, there are other areas that we may not want to think about, but history has a way of wanting to tap you on the shoulder and remind you of what she thinks is important. But we want to look at all these issues in the context of our partner in the Department of the Navy, the United States Marine Corps, and to look how she is set up to best move towards what we believe are the expected challenges and missions that she'll need to perform here in the next decade or two. And our guest for the full hour to discuss this topic will be Dakota L. Wood, Lieutenant Colonel, United States Marine Corps retired. He is a Senior Research Fellow at Defense Programs at the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign and National Security Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Dakota, welcome back to Midrats.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me back. It's a great show.
Well, thank you very much. And it's great having you on board. And one thing we'd like to do, just to kind of kick things off here, because I know everybody has been focused on the developments in, the lack of a better phrase, calling it the Crimea crisis. And there's lots of different ways to look at it, the, you know, Russia's historical stake in it. But really, I think it's helpful to look at it on what nations will do, what they'll go through, and the risks they will take to have secure and ready access to a warm water port in an area that is critical to their national security requirements. And looking at that from that context, what are some of the fundamental things about the study of why nations take actions they do should we think about with the Crimea crisis as it's going on right now?
Yeah, I think you laid out really a great framework for that. The nations will act in their own interest. Sometimes those interests are really well served by creating alliances or some kind of a treaty relationship with other countries. It's a way of extending a nation's capabilities into other areas or capability sets that they wouldn't otherwise possess. So, for instance, if the United States can't be permanently present in the Western Pacific, Asia Pacific, you have then a strong relationship with Japan or some other country that can help out in that thing. So sometimes alliances are good. Sometimes, though, you have such a core interest that you just have to look after it yourself. So you look at what your natural resources are, what means you have at your disposal, push out your influence.
Dakota, I think we lost you here for a second. You might just be in a bad spot. Are you still there?
Looks like he vanished from our system here.
We do. Well, I'll tell you what, Eagle One, if you want to tap dance, we'll see about calling Mr. Dakota right back.
Okay, well, everybody check their video, and you can watch me tap dance.
I guess it's your...
Your call has been forwarded to an automated voice messaging system. 2527
Well, odds are, next time I dial, I will go into a side briefing room. We'll give Dakota another 30 seconds, but I'm looking forward to hear what he has to say, because the that particular topical area is something that, you know, that news is going to be with us for a while, and there have been a lot of discussions about the, you know, the historical desire, you know, the Turks actually have as legitimate claim to that as anybody else. But the big picture item of why that the Crimea Peninsula is so important, it all goes back to geography. And
well,
that's when
I
hand it over to you to prattle for a bit while I go into a side room and see if I can pull Dakota back in.
All right. You point out a good, make a good point, though. I mean, a warm water point in the port in the Crimea does not do Russia any as much good as it could if they had access to the Mediterranean without having to go through the Sea of Marmaris and the Dardanelles, which they don't. So one of the keys to the future of that area is what happens in Turkey, which is undergoing its own issues right now. And is, as I understand it, about 25% of their natural gas is supplied by Russia. So they have some interest in what is going on with Russia, and Russians have some a path which they have not been reluctant to use in the past to, you know, control the behavior of the people to whom they provide natural gas. And I see the ringy dingies going on over in the chat and in the phone calls. Sam, if you got some comments on the Russian things, I see you're typing something. So for those in the chat room, in some posts earlier this month, I did put out my thoughts on the what we should do. Oh no, no what? Now I'm gone too.
No. You're still here. I'm back.
Hilbeck, Sinka. Yeah.
Hopefully we don't have an issue with the battery, but we'll give Dakota a couple of minutes, and then we'll try again. We'll kind of leave the Ukraine thing off to the side for him if you want to.
Yeah,
but
what I was pointing out was that you made a good point about the warm water port, but the real key to that area is the Dardanelles and the Sea of Marmaris, which Turkey controls. And, you know, we've got some issues. Turkey's got its own internal issues right now. Plus, they're dependent to a large extent on natural gas from Russia and also from Iran, as Sam points out. And,
I think that's one of the things in the post-Cold War era that we saw when they were building all these gas links to Western Europe, and that's grown and grown and grown, where these nations have become so dependent on Russia for their natural gas. It's an incredible weapon to use against these countries. You know, Northern Europe is known for its winters. And if you have the ability to threaten a democratically elected government with the loss of their ability for their people to have heat during the winter, that's an incredible, credible threat. Hey, Dakota has called us back, so 3-2-1, let's bring him back.
Thought you guys were going to shuck me off there.
Dakota, it's great to have you back here. I'm glad you didn't have a wreck.
You know, I have to say, I've been driving through a rainstorm, so, calls might be spotty, but it's instances like this that always make me chuckle. when I hear the defense community talk about seamless comms in a combat environment. You know, it's just silliness, right? So, you know, here we're in a perfectly benign environment in the U.S., you know, solid 3G communication. Nobody's actively trying to, you know, disrupt or anything like that. And, you know, we have what we have. So, anyway.
Yeah, I take your cynicism quite well. I have to control myself between anger and laughing whenever I hear somebody said, "Oh, but the network, it's part of the network." I was like, "You know what?
Exactly.
There's a lot of people have it all switched to that network. Let's war game that, shall we?" Always an adventure.
Yeah, exactly.
But let's head back to what we were discussing with Ukraine before we died. Over to you.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, I was kind of talking about, you know, what nations will do in their own self-interest. And certainly there are, you know, economic measures. There are diplomatic measures they will undertake. But there is also the physical control of things that are very, very important to them. It could be an energy resource. It could be agricultural resources. You know, do I have access to an area that produces food for me or sources of protein? Certainly one of the biggest tussles in the Pacific area that China is currently disputing ownership of various islands has to do with the mineral wealth of the economic zones that surround ownership of a particular island or fishing rights. And so I think what we have here in the Black Sea and specifically in the Crimea region is Russia really wanting to lay permanent claim to access to a permanent warm water port, which allows their Black Sea fleets to operate unimpeded by iced over conditions. The Black Sea fleet's important because going through the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles, it gets them into the Mediterranean, and it really extends this ability to intimidate neighbors, you know, whether it's Georgia, other areas of the Caucasus region, or you know, the Crimea in particular. So this is really important. Largely ethnic Russians, Vladimir Putin feels that it was unfairly lost at the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and he sees a window of opportunity to reclaim all this, and make some real strategic gains for the motherland. So I don't find this surprising at all. What is disappointing is the more tepid kind of, you know, lack response from Western Europe and certainly from the United States that, you know, a bully needs to be confronted. That's what we should be doing.
Well, speaking of countries acting in their best interest, we seem to be undergoing a budgetary process, which you've written rather strong words on, and one of the aspects of that is a reduction in the size of the Marines, the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, and probably the Coast Guard, too. Could you kind of talk about where you see this going?
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole argument is couched in a bunch of subterfuge and obfuscation, and people clouding the argument. For example, Secretary Hagel, a couple weeks ago when he did the preview of the budget, it was a great one-hour session or so with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. What they were presenting was the desired budget and the desired force that is well in excess of what the sequestration levels that are required, you know, the Budget Control Act of 2011 and all. And then they had these little footnoted comments about, now, Congress, if you don't give us the extra money that we would like, then this is the consequence and the level of risk and the reduced force sizes. So the Army would drop down to 420,000, the Marine Corps would drop to 174 or thereabouts. I think it was a real missed opportunity where the administration could have said, at sequestration levels of funding, this is the military we have, all these reduced levels, and this is the level of strategic risk that the nation would accept or would have to put up with. If that level of risk isn't tolerable, then we have to have additional resources. So I think there was a missed opportunity there. What the Pentagon and the services, though, lining up behind the Secretary of Defense, I mean, it's civilian control of the military, what they're doing is trying to put the best picture on a very ugly situation. So, for instance, the QDR and the FY15 budget and the FYDP that goes along with that is saying that we are trading manpower levels or capacity of the force for modernization, you know, getting newer stuff further on down the line, and ensuring that the smaller force we have is as ready as possible. So investing in, again, a future procurement of more modern systems and making sure that the smaller force you have has enough money to pay for maintenance, exercises, training, those kinds of things. So they would say that at the requested budget level, we don't have a hollow force, we have a ready force, and we're making sure that investments are being made so that things like the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter and other types of major procurement programs continue. I think that the incorrect aspect of that argument, though you have a smaller force that's ready, the smallness is still a strategic risk that we are accepting, where we have global interests, and if you expect to go up against a near peer or a peer competitor and some kind of conventional operation, then attrition becomes an issue. You have to account for losses. You have to account for a desired overmatch capability in any kind of confrontation. And so a smaller force simply means that you'll be able to do less things and that the size of the engagements that you can attend to have to account for that smaller force. It was also very specifically stepping away from a two major regional contingency or a two MRC force sizing construct, with the administration saying we can handle one major thing well and we'll be able to shake our finger very vigorously at somebody else who's trying to exploit our inability to respond in another theater. And I think that's just creating a window of exploitation that somebody's going to see an opportunity and take advantage of that. And I just think it's a very bad path to be on. And Congress and the administration need to relook at sequestration, and they need to fund defense at required levels of capability based on threat assessments and where we believe our interests lie in the various regions where we have interests.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and, you know, we can kind of fold in Ukraine's experience. Is, you know, decision was made by Ukraine to, and they're a poor country, but you can usually tell by the effort a nation is making as a percentage of their GDP that they spend on national defense, and Ukraine was less than 2%. And the old adage, you know, weakness invites aggression. And there are things that have happened, you know, recently, whether we're talking about the ephemeral red line in Syria, the body language around some national leaders compared to ours, and some of the empty statements. There's an ongoing display of weakness and aggression. When you look at our traditional allies as well, you see additional signals coming from them that continue signaling this weakness. Being that national defense and national policy really is an executive branch organization, if not Secretary Hagel to deliver that message about additional risks and weakness, is there a voice in the executive branch that would or should put that out, or is this really just the administration policy's desire to demilitarize many aspects of our foreign policy and look more towards the diplomatic, information, and economic aspects of national power? And until you have a change in philosophy at the front, that this is going to be our reality for a while, because I really haven't seen any desire or indication of a change in theme coming from the present administration.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, you tee up some very complex issues. yet when you're talking about nation states, you know, relating to each other and looking at their national interests, you know, there is such a complexity of factors. I mean, you have domestic policy, you have the philosophical view of whoever it is that's in charge, whether it's a party or an individual. You know, what are their priorities? How do they view both their own country and relationships with other countries. And I think it's been interesting that the Secretary of State, John Kerry, and others have really been pointing out that Vladimir Putin, for example, isn't behaving like an enlightened 21st century statesman, that they're mired in this Cold War 20th century kind of, you know, way of behaving. And I think that kind of criticism really misses the point. It might be that they aren't behaving as we would like them to behave, but the reality is they are behaving the way they are behaving. So if our security policies, if our foreign policy doesn't account for the actual nature of the world in which we have to operate, then we will be making very poorly informed decisions about how to secure our own interests. So if we're working with crazed mullahs in Iran, or you're working with Bashar al-Assad in Syria, or you're working with religious extremists having to deal with religious extremism in Nigeria, where it's the Muslims against the Christians, you know, just those kinds of realities. And our security discussions internal to the U.S., our foreign policy, don't account for those realities, then we're going to be making very bad decisions. So with respect to this current administration and much of Congress, if their priorities are domestic policy, expansion of entitlement programs, accounting for the various benefits that are in the non-discretionary accounts, you know, the mandated spending accounts of our country, then that's where their focus is going to be. So we'll continue with deficit spending. We'll continue with the accrual of ever-increasing amounts of national debt. And that has to be paid for somehow. And right now, the easiest target is to say that after 10 or 12 or 13 years of war, defense is where we need to take those reductions. So that's what we're seeing. The worldview is the United States needs to be less aggressive. It needs to be less of a prima donna among other countries. And so let's reduce the aggressiveness in a lot of our foreign policies. And so you're going to see underfunding or reduced funding and a shifting of priorities from defense into these other domestic-oriented accounts. And we're seeing that playing out in these budget discussions. The worldview, view of domestic policy and those policy priorities by this administration, and it's really not a surprise we don't see them making the argument that the world is a dangerous place. We need to have the material ability to secure our interests and be in a sufficiently forward-leaning presence that other actors in the world, Iran, North Korea, Russia, China, Syria, the Palestinians in terms of Hezbollah, et cetera, that they don't get overly aggressive, thinking that they can do things that we won't be able to respond to. So deterrence and dissuasion are a very big aspect of what Reagan talked about in Peace Through Strength. It's a very big part of what Teddy Roosevelt talked about when he said, speak softly but carry a big stick. The soft diplomatic talk is only effective if the person to whom you're talking sees that you have a very big stick and you're not beyond using that stick if the talk doesn't work.
A lot of the news stories recently about the cuts in defense or the proposed cuts in defense noted that the Army would be the smallest army since before World War II, and I think Claude Barrabee pointed out somewhere that the Navy is already at its lowest level since perhaps before World War I. What do these cuts do to the Marine Corps? It didn't look like it was that many total in numbers, but
right.
What does it do to Corps?
Yeah, I think of all the services, the Marine Corps is coming out in the very best position. So these should really be heady days for the Marine Corps. They've positioned themselves very well in the crisis response role. The Marine Corps is postured culturally, as a service, to embrace expeditionary types of operations, going in very light, high mobility, kind of that forward-leaning posture. That's what it does as a service. and this is a world that really calls for that kind of capability. So in terms of reduction in force, you know, they didn't expect to stay at 202,000. They already had plans to come on down. They were hoping it would be in the 180s. I think the 175, 174 level is actually where they're going to end up at. The Commandant has said that, you know, you're accepting some risk of doing that, and that is true, because it will probably bring them down to about 21 infantry battalions. But in terms of programmatics, in the next few years, they'll have a completely new air arm. You know, they're well on their way to getting the F-35B Stovall, a joint strike fighter. They've got the Yankee Zulu program for their Cobras and Hueys. They have a new variant of the C-130 coming online. They've almost completed purchase of the MV-22 Osprey to completely replace the old CH-46 Sea Knights. And, you know, it just goes on. So in terms of air capabilities and the ability to support operations abroad, their air side is doing very, very well. They do have some new ground fire support capabilities. They've got a new mortar coming on the line. But where they're really hurting, I think, is on the ground mobility side. You all have probably tracked very closely, you know, the cancellation of the EFV and now stepping back for the amphibious combat vehicle and how that program has been re-envisioned. I think they're going to go in a wheel direction instead of a track swimming vehicle, because they keep talking about connectors, which means some other kind of sea platform that gets stuff from ships to shore but doesn't go ashore. And I think it'd be interesting for your audience to kind of get into that. But the Marine Corps has invested itself in special purpose MAGTAFs of various sizes for crisis response for Africa. They have the Black Sea Rotational Force. They're expanding their presence out of Darwin, where they'll have a rotational force out of Darwin, Australia. And they're just really coming in, I want to say coming into their own, but as they shift operations from Afghanistan to this crisis response posture, they're doing very, very well. As you indicated, though, the Navy is not doing very well at all in terms of the number of hulls in the water. And to the extent that the Marine Corps wants to get back into sea-based operations, it will find the Navy's difficulty in funding its shipbuilding program to be an impediment to Marine Corps desires. So the Marine Corps has long said 40 amphibs are required to meet combatant command requirements. 38 would do pretty well, fiscally constrained to 33 in order to have 30 or 28 or so operationally available. But I think their actual experience has meant that they've only had 17 or 18 amphibs available at any given time. So when we talk about actual warfighting capabilities, the Navy is proving to be a bottleneck for these forward-deployed sea-based Marine Corps assets. Current imbroglio over the defense budget is not going to assist that matter, you know, in any way at all. So the Marine Corps is now exploring other alternatives. What can you do with non-standard naval shipping? Can you operate off of other platforms? How might you leverage the littoral combat ship or the JHSV family or approach to joint high-speed vessels? What does the mobile landing platform, the MLP, that's being put out in the fleet, how does that work? And so it's really a time of experimentation and innovation for the Marine Corps as a service, as it really tries to figure out how to make that 175 to 185 Marine Corps work in this crisis response mode.
You know, you hit on a topic, and I definitely want to get to the lessons learned from the cancellation of the EFV, but the numbers of amphibious ships, one thing that's been concerning me for quite a while, and I think the concern has got a bold-faced underline on it now with the advancements and really the spread of anti-access and area denial weapons, is, you know, when you look at the USS America class that we're building, it's roughly the size of the French CVN, the Charles de Gaulle. It doesn't have a well deck. That's kind of a different topic for a different day, perhaps. But You also have LPD-17, not a small ship. So not only do we have fewer ships, but the ships we have are larger. They carry more equipment. They carry more Marines. And almost we're setting up ourselves in a situation where you have a tactical risk of losing a ship that can quickly turn into an operational or even strategic risk where you are in danger of one mine hit or one golden BB away from just not having, losing so many with the loss of one ship, that you don't have the ability to carry out the mission you've already been committed to. Do you see any effort, and you mentioned a couple of them, which are, you know, smaller ships, to look closer on not just the economies of scale efficiency of the larger ships, but making sure that we're thinking about what risks we're taking on board with these large ships with all the equipment on that and being able to spread that risk around when we get up near the front?
Yeah, I it's a great point. And this is really where you get into some graduate level thinking about warfare, operational concepts, how do you organize, equip your force, all those things. That the larger but fewer number of major combatants that you mentioned really is a metaphor for the whole approach that we have taken to our primary platforms. But we want to give our guys the absolute best that we can provide. So we typically generate requirements that are very extreme. We want these things to do everything in terms of being able to see the environment, to respond to that, to have onboard weapon systems and all that stuff. So we ask for the moon. The industry comes back and says, yes, we can do that for you. This is what it's going to cost. Everybody chokes a little bit on the price tag and says, well, no, let's go ahead and go that. That inevitably means is we have fewer numbers of very, very capable platforms. So, you know, former Undersecretary Bob Work, who's probably going to be DefSec Def, has written about this extensively, that we may have fewer platforms, fewer holes in the water, that each one of those is so much more capable than any other platform we've ever had or any other platforms that our competitors might have, that it's almost comparing apples and oranges. But to the point that you brought up, each one of those things represents a certain amount of combat power for the force that you kick out there. So when we do consider the potential for attrition in a warfight, whether it's a torpedo shot or a mine or just a simple engineering casualty, where the power plant goes offline or something, when that ship comes offline, you have lost a proportionally greater percentage of your total combat power. So the fewer you get in number, even though those fewer are individually more capable, when you lose one of those things, you have lost a high percentage of what your force was taking to the field. I think that's a bad approach. We have that in the B-2 fleet. We have that in the Joint Strike Fighter procurement. We have that anytime. We had that in the EFV before it was canceled. Remember, it was supposed to, you know, acquire like over 1,000 or so, and the platform became so expensive that they lowered the numbers to about 570 or something like that. So we want very advanced platforms, but that drives us to fewer numbers of platforms, which means that when I actually commit them to combat, attrition takes a proportionally greater toll, which then brings into question how long I can sustain operations over time when I am dealing with an ever-sophisticated and more mature competitor threat. So as you see this proliferation of advanced technologies, guided munitions, anti-ship cruise missiles, you know, guided mortar rounds, the proliferation of technologies that let other actors see at night, where previously we've been the only one with night vision types of devices and all that, I think the combat environment becomes more lethal, not less lethal. Signature battles become very important. You know, what are you emitting? What's your energy spectrum, et cetera? And there is an increased likelihood that you will have to absorb combat losses. So that brings the discussion really full circle into how we envision equipping the battle force that we want to have. and, you know, what is its ability to defend itself? Now, that doesn't mean that every competitor you come up against is some 10-foot giant that's going to be perfect in the battle, and somehow or other we are always missing the boat. I mean, that's not the case. But this fact of attrition and fewer numbers will really, really become an issue if we ever engage in major combat. Now, if you believe that that's never going to happen, then what's the point of having a force that is equipped for major combat, you know, to begin with? So, you know, we're buying this stuff for a reason. We've got conventionally armed and equipped forces for a reason. So then we just logically have to carry that argument forward and assume that at some point we'll be engaged in some major theater war, or major combat operation against a competitor, and we will suffer losses. So what's our ability to withstand it? And I just think that, you know, the numbers in terms of costs as we look at high technology solutions has a consequence, and we have not really dealt with that conceptually in our envisioning of the force of the field.
Yeah, one of the questions that raises is, you know, that we have this F-35 Bravo, which is a pretty high-tech piece of gear. Could the Marines
Yes.
Use a less expensive version of something to accomplish the same sort of mission? I mean, are we talking close air support for the Marines? Or I mean, is there an alternative which would take a large chunk of the Marine Corps money?
Right. Well, there are alternatives, and it comes down to, again, how you envision a battle unfolding and what capabilities and really what options you want to have a commander to have. So there are very strong arguments on each side of this, you know, is F-35 be good or bad? And, you know, there are strong arguments either way. A strong argument in favor is if you don't want to be limited to fixed-wing operations at sea off of a limited number of aircraft carriers, then you go with a STOVL capability, and you essentially double your aircraft carrier fleet. So these LHAs, LHDs can operate fixed-wing aircraft, strike aircraft, off of, you know, a shorter, you know, runway, essentially, at sea. And so I've got more of these things that complicate the enemy's defensive calculations. So it opens up opportunities for a commander to place capabilities in more areas, threaten the enemy from more axes of approach, and it decreases my dependency on the CDN proper or the limited number of airfields that I might have access to when I start looking at trends in a particular region. So, you know, the short answer is it increases options and gives me greater flexibility. I can look at austere sites. I can look at developing a lily pad approach. I can look at creating advanced bases and again, complicating the enemy's defensive calculations. The arguments on the other side are, yes, but these things are coming at such an extreme price that couldn't I buy other or, you know, more platforms for the same amount of money or envision different ways of approaching that combat environment? So, for instance, if I could buy more F-18s for what I'm paying for the F-35, then I have, you know, more assets, especially if I'm expecting attrition. So I could use the Navy proper to provide the fixed-wing support. And if I'm assuming that the Air Force is going to show up at airfields, you know, ashore, then I preserve my amphib fleet for MV-22, you know, long-range raid-type operations or attack helicopter. And I get these things in close, and I use this force in a peripheral naval campaign where I'm either seizing advanced bases from which I can operate, you know, larger fixed-wing aircraft, or I can threaten the enemy's peripheral interests, you know, as interdict sea lines of communication, take out smaller supporting naval bases, you know, from which he might be conducting flotilla operations, you know, those kinds of things. So where the Marine Corps has come down, saying, no, we want our own fixed-wing strike aircraft capability for, you know, close air support or whatever that might be, We don't want to be critically reliant or dependent on carrier, large-scale carrier operations when the platform might be vulnerable getting in close, or since I only have 10 or 11 of them, that I don't have enough to support these amphibious operations. And so I want an independent capability. If you go down that route, you need a STOVL aircraft, and that brings us back to where we're at. So there is no other program to replace the Harrier. We have placed our bet on the F-35, and again, there are pros and cons. Commonality in parts, avionics packages, and those kinds of things. But because it's a single design that has to satisfy the individual requirements of three different customers, by necessity, it had to be sub-optimized in any one of those areas. So for the Air Force, their version, the F-35A, is not an F-22 Raptor. It is not going to be the best air superiority fighter, and so they have had to compromise because they had to account for Marine Corps requirements. For the Navy, their Charlie version is not an F-18 strike aircraft. It's going to be something less than that. So the three services have said that what it's bringing in terms of ISR capabilities, its avionics package, its helmet-mounted capability that ties or integrates the pilot more into the sensor packages and the weapons package on the aircraft, and its purported stealth capabilities, that will more than make up for the deficiencies it has in sub-optimization and the deficiencies it might have in sub-optimized performance characteristics in fewer numbers. So it's a gambit, but there is a logic behind it. I don't think it's the best approach that we could have taken, but it's where the Marine Corps has really put its eggs.
Yeah, and all those eggs in one basket for everybody.
In one basket.
I wanted to back up a bit.
Just on the one eggs thing, it goes back to your original point about fewer numbers. In warfare, more options are usually better. And when you talk about critical vulnerabilities in the system that you're putting together, the architecture that you're putting into place, we are betting everything on a single type of aircraft across three services. So if it turns out that there is a performance vulnerability that an enemy is able to figure out, or there is some kind of a design flaw, premature metal fatigue, or there's a software glitch or something like that, that downs that fleet of aircraft or makes that fleet vulnerable, we will have no other options. And so I think from a strategic approach to fielding combat capabilities, just as we're going fewer in number because of the bets we've placed on the high-priced technologies, we're making similar risky investments into necking down the type model series of aircraft or the types of ships or ground combat vehicles that we're fielding. So there are economic efficiencies that you're gaining, but I'm worried about the combat effectiveness in real-world application.
Speaking of the secondary effect of failed programs, I wanted to back up a bit, and let's talk a bit about the replacement for the AAV-7. Lots and lots of time, lots of money, lots of professional reputations were wasted in the development of the expeditionary fighting vehicle that was eventually canceled. You mentioned, as a capability, getting Marines ashore is a capability we have to have. So, Plan B, looking for a replacement, and they are looking at wheeled vice track options. I had a couple questions for you. What are some of the trade-offs you experience going from a tracked to a wheeled? And because of the experience with the EFV, are we likely to go with an existing platform adapted for the Marine Corps usage? And what do you think are the top two or three lessons learned from the whole EFV lack of a exemplary program?
Yeah, I think one lesson is committing too early to a major program before you have some of the technologies worked out. The Army experienced the same exact problem in their Future Combat System program. If you remember back to the late 90s, on that, late 90s to early 2000. Future Combat System was a whole set of systems that were supposed to be working hand in glove, that they were critically dependent on, I don't know, a dozen or so yet undeveloped futuristic technologies, and they could just never make it work out, even with all the money they were throwing at it. So for the EFE, the idea was a very high-speed, top-of-the-water planing armored vehicle that would close an ever-widening ship-to-shore gap, with the ships being pushed further away due to advances in anti-ship cruise missile technologies. So you don't want Marines out there bobbing around for, you know, 4, 5, 7, 8 hours. You just get ashore and they're, you know, completely ineffective because everybody's seasick. So they had to close that gap very quickly, and this expeditionary fighting vehicle was envisioned to do that. For about $4 billion in development, they found that the compromises they had to make in lightening the vehicle so they could get high speed meant that you didn't have the armor that you would likely need once you got the vehicle ashore and actually went straight into a fight. Because the idea is ship to shore, straight into the fight, so you can catch the enemy by surprise, seize the objective and all that. Well, you just couldn't do it with a heavily armored vehicle in a heavily lethal anti-armor environment because of the design requirements for this particular thing. Also, the shape of the vehicle meant that in a high IED threat environment, you have very low ground clearance, and lack of a space is one of the worst things when you're dealing with an underbelly or a roadside type blast. So how do you get a tracked vehicle higher off the ground so there is more space for that blast to dissipate? And they just couldn't solve all those problems with the technology currently available and the money that they had available. So they canceled that program, went back to our analysis of alternatives, and re-looked at what it was going to cost in terms of time and money to still have a track vehicle that was high-speed capable. The advantages of high speed, especially with track, is that you can keep pace with M1 Abrams, you know, tank, mechanized operations. In open terrain, you have great trafficability with those tracks. If you have to clamber over a beach or reefs or, you know, broken terrain, even coming ashore, tracks do a lot for you. But again, those cause compromises in vehicle design when you need to move from ship to shore very rapidly. As they also started to think through the problem, they thought, well, where do we think we might be fighting? And if you're talking about operations in the littorals, and especially if you consider heavily urbanized littorals, then taking lessons from operations in Iraq and some of the little towns and stuff in Afghanistan, you find that large tracked vehicles make it very difficult to operate in and around urban areas. So when you're dealing with paved roads, urban congestion, power lines, and then especially with that IED threat that I mentioned, a wheeled vehicle that gets you higher off the ground and maneuvers this type of terrain just has more advantages over a tracked kind of vehicle. So the problem now confronting the Marine Corps is, if I think that my on-land combat capability favors wheeled vehicles for fuel consumption, IED threat countering that, the types of environments I might be operating in, how do I get a wheeled vehicle from ships, which in their new EF-21 concept, they purport the ships will need to operate from as far away as 65 nautical miles. I can't swim a wheeled vehicle that distance. So they now have to work with the Navy and say, are there different approaches to these connectors, so a follow-on or a successor to the LCAC or some high-speed variant to the LCU? And back to the point that you made about how quickly something like this might be fielded, General Amos, the commandant, has said that he would like to see a solution in place before he leaves office. Well, you can't develop something like that whole cloth in just a couple of years. So they're going to have to look at what industry is already able to provide, and there are 3 or 4 or 5 variants out there, armored, wheeled, you know, multi-axle, multi-wheel type drive vehicles, and I think that's where the effort is currently going. So the ACV program, I think, will actually be the more like the MPC, the Marine Personnel Carrier Program, and that they will marry that to a connector that gets these things from ship to shore in a reasonable period of time. And I just think that's where they're at in terms of time and money and division capability for the size of the force that they want to have executing the types of operations they think are most likely for a crisis response force.
There are a couple of questions that probably Sal will get from the chat room, but I wanted to ask about the Marines as a special operations force in and of itself. I know that it seems like the tendency has been to use the Marines as infantry, almost like the Army in some of our recent things. Is there a move in the Marine Corps to make it more of our 9-11 force? Has you know, like Army Airborne or some of the other special operations
right.
commands?
Yeah, I would not use the term special operations in describing the Marine Corps. Where mistakes occur, I believe, a misinterpretation, when people start talking about soft and soft life, is special operations that really have more to do with legal authority that enable certain military forces in U.S. inventory to do things that conventional forces cannot do. The other part to that is it might be a special skill that takes a very long time to master and a lot of time to remain competent in that a conventional force just doesn't have time or the resources to invest, you know, to get good at and to maintain that proficiency. So the special operations units we have legal authorities that conventional forces don't have, and they have the time and the resources to field certain capabilities, whether it's an insertion or extract capability or what have you, that conventional forces wouldn't have. But what the Marine Corps is able to bring is, again, this kind of middleweight force that is culturally and organizationally postured to respond very quickly when crises emerge. So if you compare forces with forces, you find that on average, not all the time, but on average, Army units are larger, not quite as nimble for a variety of reasons. Awesome war-winning force, but not quite as nimble or adaptive as the Marine Corps unit. The Marine Corps has, again, positioned itself very well with these forward-deployed special-purpose MAGTAFs, where it's a smaller unit, usually battalion size or smaller, with its own air capabilities, usually MV-22 Ospreys with 1,000 nautical mile range, and their own organic logistics capability that enables them to respond very quickly to an emergent kind of thing. So folks are quick to talk about a Benghazi kind of incident or reinforcing of an embassy or a non-combatant evacuation operation of civilians from some war-torn area. And these packages of forward-deployed Marines are very well postured to be able to do that. And that's where the Marine Corps is really putting its emphasis right now, is this quick response, crisis response, medium weight capability that the COCOMs, or the geographic combat commanders, find very valuable to have on hand.
Right after 9/11, what was interesting to watch in the Army was the Army all of a sudden was trying to rediscover counterinsurgency, and the Marines with their old small wars manual was like, well, we never really forgot it. And the Army in the last couple of years is the koinonistas, so to speak, versus the traditionals. That battle's been fought in the open to a fair bit.
Right.
Question I wanted to roll your way, intellectually, how is the Marine Corps going to look at the lessons of the last dozen years or so at war, counterinsurgency, while at the same time what we have seen is the Marine Corps is trying to get back to basics. Basics being, you know, being able to project power ashore, working with the Navy more. How do you see that intellectual balance taking place?
Yeah, I don't think it's as big a problem for the Marine Corps at all as perhaps it was for the Army. You know, we tend to forget that 2003 took down Saddam Hussein's conventional forces almost without blinking an eye. I mean, very successful, very rapid conventional operations. You know, nobody could beat the U.S. Army. When you start talking about counterinsurgency, it really then gets into an upper political level about what is your theory of victory? What are you trying to accomplish against a particular type of foe, right? And a counterinsurgency operation usually takes many, many years and is very manpower intensive. And you have to be more nuanced in your utilization of force because you don't want to destroy infrastructure or estrange the population. You're trying to be very discreet in who and what you target and how you go about doing that. And it just takes a very, very long time. So on the Army side, the battle between the Coinistas and the conventional guys are that the Army had become too focused on counterinsurgency and had forgotten or was stepping away from this idea that the Army is there primarily to win wars. And that if there's something longer term or some kind of a stabilization operation, that's a political decision on whether or not the nation has the national will to stay engaged in one theater or one country for the next decade. And those that would champion the Army getting back to more of a warfighting focus in a conventional sense say that this is tough enough as it is, and we can't afford to forget about that. For the Marine Corps, it's all about tactical proficiency. So I've got a great, you know, fire team or squad or platoon or company or what have you, and if I'm tactically proficient, then how I go about, you know, executing my patrols, when to shoot, when not to shoot, how I generate and leverage, you know, the intel on the battlefield, how I command and control those forces, those skill sets are applicable whether they're being applied in, you know, a stabilization or a coin kind of environment, or you're doing a crisis response kind of mode. So the Marine Corps has kept its focus on ensuring that small unit tactics, small unit leadership are really at the forefront and where they see the greatest need for utilization of forces for the next decade or so, you know, as we're out of Afghanistan. It's going to be in quickly responding to an emergent crisis. For them, you know, the whole maneuver warfare mentality, the small wars doctrine that came out of the, you know, the 1930s, et cetera, and in the 40s, was really all about small unit tactical proficiency. How you use that and why, to what political end, is a higher order discussion. But I just think that they're not going to miss much of a beat at all in shifting from Afghanistan types of things to this crisis response posture. So I think they're very much what better position than the Army is.
Well, that raises a question that was asked in our chat room, which is operational maneuver from the sea and ship to objective movement, are those still a viable doctrine? And what does DISOPS do to those?
Yeah, no, they are, because, you know, both of them say that, look, we've got this entire expanse of ocean, which goes all over the place. How can we think about leveraging that as maneuver space, you know, instead of being tied to a road network or a port or an airfield or being channeled by a mountain range or a set of valleys? So if I can operate with great flexibility in the maritime environment, then the challenge becomes, how do I transition combat power or military power from that sea base to anywhere I need to go ashore? So operational maneuver from the sea, got it. Ship to objective maneuver, I want to try to get from my sea base as rapidly and as effectively into the objective area as possible without having to drag myself across, you know, 100 miles of road or jungle or deserts. And so I think those remain viable, and they're trying the best they can to leverage the range and speed of the MV-22 Osprey and then to go back to the ship-to-shore thing for surface movement. What kinds of surface connectors get my ground capability from amphibs to the beach and into the objective area as expeditiously and as effectively as possible. That's something that they're having to grapple with.
Well, Dakota, that has been a very, very fast hour, and I just wanted to take an opportunity to thank you for taking time this afternoon to come in, talk about a little bit of current operations, so to speak, but also to give everybody some items to think about on how we're going to keep the Marine Corps where we need it to be going forward. And one thing I wanted to roll up for you, if you could, just tell us what you're working on right now at Heritage that we should keep an eye on to read when you come out. And for those that are still focused on what's breaking right now in Ukraine, are there a couple of people or a couple of locations that you'd recommend for people to either put in their Google search or put on their favorites for the next few weeks as this unfolds?
Well, I mean, there at Heritage, Jim Carafano, who oversees all of our defense and foreign policy efforts, is a prolific writer. So you just Google Carafano or Stephen Bucci, who is in charge of our defense programs. They've really been putting some out there. So that's just some real quick references for other people who are writing. Within Heritage, I guess the two big things are continue to make arguments that we fund and resource defense in accordance with our national interests and the evolving threat environment. And to the extent that we subfund that or we don't do that in favor of domestic, especially entitlement programs, we are increasing our national risk relative to what the rest of the world is doing. And then the other major program we're just getting going is developing a measure of military power for the U.S. So the defense programs are really only looked at each year in and of themselves, but we have no index, no measure that allows us from year to year to see if our defense portfolio is making progress and meeting one and a two MRC metric, sizing metric, and two, ensuring that our combatant commanders have the resources they need to protect and defend U.S. interests. So those are the two big projects we've got going on.
Perfect. We will keep an eye open for that, and I hope you have a great spring, Dakota.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show. You guys are doing great stuff, and it's always a pleasure to be talking with you.
Well, thank you for coming on.
All right, take care.
Thanks, you too, Dakota. And thanks, everybody, for joining us here for another edition of MidRats. Join us next week where we're going to have a few representatives from the CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell, CRIC, and talk about what they're working on and what they've got inside, outside, next to the box. And until then, hope everybody has a great Navy and, in deference to Dakota, Marine Corps Day. Cheers.
Hoping you're the same.